for a furlough scheme and raising universal credit, Rishi Sunak has pitched himself as something other than a traditional Tory Chancellor, but with the announcement today of a public sector pay freeze and cuts to the international aid budget, is billionaire Sunak putting his inner class warrior on show? That's our main question for tonight. I'm delighted to be joined by Ash Sarkar. How are you doing, Ash?
Oh, mate, I'm gutted.
Oh, is this the Maradona news?
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously, a very, very flawed human being, but Maradona was unmatched in his time and unrivaled afterwards. Just the sheer joy and elan and mischief that accompanied his style of play. Obviously, he was long past playing by the time I was interested in football, but he was like an institution in our house. My mum would often say that the hand of God was her favourite goal ever scored. Gutted. Feel really gutted.
I love your way to make everything into an excuse to sort of get under the skin of English nationalists by saying the hand of God was the best goal. James Meadway is also joining us tonight. Navarra Media columnist, economics extraordinaire, former advisor to Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell. James, how's it going?
Not too bad, thank you. I share Ash's sentiment about Maradona, actually. I don't know. Do people see the documentary from like a couple of years ago?
No, I've been meaning to. Someone was saying his politics were actually quite good.
His politics are actually quite good. As Ash says, quite a flawed individual, but it's basically about his time at Napoli and the sort of extraordinary reception he has there in this southern Italy. I mean, it's a brilliant city, but it's sort of always treated, if you got Aaron on, he'd probably bang on about this much more than I would, but it's always sort of treated as like the wrong end of Italy, not really Italians. And it's really sort of this dramatic relationship he has with the city and the football and the mafia and the drug taking and all the rest of it, and the politics ends up mixed up in that. But yeah, quite... it's sad news to see him go, and see him go quite young as well.
I mean, if you didn't already know, Diego Maradona, age 60, has passed away today, which isn't going to be one of our main stories tonight, because I think I'm probably not well placed to do his life and career justice. But obviously, a very sad story. We are, as well as a spending review, which is going to take up the first half of the show, we're going to talk about the EHRC finding that the Home Office had broken equalities law or had not complied with the law in its development of the Windrush policy. And we're going to end the show with a segment on the fairly brutal clampdown from the top of the Labour Party against anyone who is trying to express their opposition to the suspension of, well, now the withholding of the whip from Jeremy Corbyn. We have an exclusive leaked email to show you, and we speak to Jess Barnard, who's chair of Young Labour, who's someone who has come a cropper with Labour's bureaucracy. Let's go to story one. Beforehand, you know what to do. Tweet on the hashtag TiskySour and share the show link. Today saw the release of the Office for Budget Responsibility report on the state of the public finances and Rishi Sunak's spending review, which set out spending commitments over the next 12 months. The OBR shows 2020 will have a deficit of £394 billion, or 19% of GDP, and that's the highest it's been since 1944. They also show debt levels are now above 100% of GDP, the first time that's been the case since 1960. Rishi Sunak has said none of this is a reason to reduce overall spending, as we're still in a crisis, but there are two areas where cutbacks are being made. One is a cut to the aid budget. We're going to talk about that in detail in one moment. First, though, this is him on public sector pay.
I'm taking three steps today. First, taking account of the pay review body's advice, we will provide a pay rise to over 1 million nurses, doctors, and others working in the NHS. Second, to protect jobs, pay rises in the rest of the public sector will be paused next year. But third, we will protect those on lower incomes. The 2.1 million public sector workers who earn below the median wage of £24,000 will be guaranteed a pay rise of at least £250. What this means, Mr. Speaker, is that while the government is making the difficult decision to control public sector pay, the majority of public sector workers will see their pay increase next year.
That was Rishi Sunak on public sector pay. Let's get up a graphic from the BBC on what were the main announcements today before I go to Meadway. So can we get this up? An estimated 1.3 million public sector workers will see their pay frozen in 2021 to 2022. Most NHS workers and those earning less than £24,000 will still get an increase, so they're excluded from the public sector pay freeze. The UK economy is expected to shrink by 11.3% this year. Unemployment is expected to reach 7.5% next spring, with 2.6 million people out of work, probably the more important figure than the ones that we're hearing about the debt. Overseas aid budget is going to be cut by £4 billion, and a new £4 billion levelling up fund will pay for upgrading local infrastructure across the UK.
To be honest, some of this is something of a non-event. It was built up for weeks and weeks. A lot of the content in the spending review, the stuff around spending more on infrastructure and capital spending outside of London, rewriting the rules for the Treasury so they're not so massively biased towards the City of London, really, in parts of the South East, various sort of bits of funding for this and that, some extra funding for education, extra funding for hospitals, but a lot of this was already announced. So it's a kind of political sort of economic terms, it's a sort of non-event because a lot of these things were already kind of going to happen. The planned spending increases for next year have been reduced somewhat, at least in terms of the sort of the non-COVID spending, but there is still going to be a spending increase overall. Overall spending for COVID next year is still something like £55 billion. So the government's still anticipating spending a lot of money there. So it's this kind of slightly odd overall. They're actually spending more money than they were, and they're planning to carry on doing that. And then you've got this kind of jab in the middle of it, directed at public sector workers, then another one on the overseas aid budget. What this means is that this is a sort of politically constructed thing rather than a budget that's trying to sort of set out a genuine plan for the future as we're trying to get out of the first phase of coronavirus. It wasn't, there's some nods in that direction. There's the levelling up and all the rest of this nonsense, but which we can come back to, actually. That's a whole little tale in itself. But then there's this political bit where Sunak can hear the noises from the Tory backbenchers about there must be cuts, we must do something about the debt. Total nonsense, by the way. The Office of Budget Responsibility figures, this is the official watchdog, publishes its forecasts and its analysis of the economy at the same time as the government publishes a spending review. And buried away in that is the rather striking revelation that interest rates for government are now so low that even with the additional borrowing this year, it's still paying less in interest than it was at the start of the year. I mean, this is spectacular. Bear in mind, interest rates of government are basically about zero around about now. And that the borrowing this year has, in any case, been matched almost exactly by additional funding from the Bank of England through quantitative easing. So there's no reason at all to be thinking about any cuts of any sort at this point in time. It's just, it shouldn't even be a question. Sunak's doing this because he needs to say something to Tory backbenchers. He needs to look like he's doing something. So he's gone for this somewhat sort of nuanced, but nonetheless still real terms cut for at least some public sector workers over there. And he's gone for the overseas aid budget, which, by the way, he's already run into trouble with. I notice there's been, what, one, when I last time I checked, ministerial resignation over it, various sort of Tory grandees kicking up a fuss. The reason Tories like the overseas aid budget is because, you can see it from their point of view, post-Brexit, we need some sort of influence in the world, and this is one way to do it. This is Britain's soft power, as far as they're concerned, the whole actually helping people in the rest of the world is a second-order issue. But that's why they're complaining about it. So it's politically put together to kind of be a holding position until they get to spring. Maybe there's a vaccine, maybe things have calmed down a bit, and then they can do an all bells and whistles budget with tax rises or whatever else it might be. So it's a bit of an odd situation to go through this. And I think people should be quite clear that this isn't just everyone back to austerity, it's 2010 all over again or whatever. We're quite a long way out of that still, and not much sign of us going back into austerity just yet.
I want to bring up some more of that OBR analysis. That's the official watchdog created by George Osborne, I think, to look into the public finances. This is a graphic they released today, sort of summarizing what their report showed. So they're saying GDP growth, and what you're seeing here is what they had thought was going to happen before the lockdown, and what is the latest estimations. So at the beginning of the year, they had predicted 1.1% growth this year. In fact, it will be minus 11.3. At the beginning of the year, they were predicting and there would be 3.9 million people unemployed next year. That's now gone up 2%, 3.9% to 7.2%, 4.8% this year. And then in terms of borrowing, what they were projecting is that we would be borrowing £55 billion this year, and that goes up to £394 billion. And by 2025, they were projecting we would be borrowing £58 billion, which has now gone up to £100 billion. And what they say in the summary, what I found quite interesting, because James has just pointed out that very significant fact, really, that even though the debt is much higher than it was, we're actually paying less than we had been previously because interest rates are so, so low. But this is how the summary from the OBR ended. So they wrote, our central forecast shows that 20 to 30 billion pounds in spending cuts or tax rises would be required to balance revenues and day-to-day spending and stop debt from rising by the end of this parliament. So James, I want to go to you for this, because obviously, you know, we can see why there are right-wingers on the Tory backbenchers who are desperate for spending cuts or for pay freezes or whatever. But this, to me, seems like, you know, the OBR, the official economic watchdog, saying we are either going to have to do spending cuts or tax rises in the next 5 years. Should we see them as sort of like a just an ideological organ, or does the implications of we need 20 to 30 billion pound in spending cuts or tax rises not necessarily mean austerity?
The issue you have is that, look, it produces forecasts. Any economic forecast is going to be attached to a great deal of uncertainty. You don't know what's going to happen in the future, which also means that any forecast you produce contains this kind of ideological element. There's always something built into it which tells you something about how you think the world operates. And the OBR use a very big, it's the old Treasury model that they kind of inherited and tweaked a bit. Very, very big. You can go and look at it and find it online if you want. Huge sort of forecasting model for how the economy operates. And you crank a handle and it produces these sort of results out the other side. And you can say in 5 years' time, it says that the gap is this big. And if the government thinks that closing that gap and bringing the debt to GDP ratio, the amount of debt we have relative to the size of the economy, back under control, in other words, not rising anymore, then this is how much additional taxes we need, or how many cuts we need to make. And the issue here, I think, is first one, the amount of uncertainty built into this is absolutely enormous. Like, we don't really know what's going to happen in 4 or 5 years' time at this point in time, even more than normal. We're still going through the pandemic, there's Brexit, there's God knows what else is going to turn up. If you look at the last 5 years, God knows what's going to happen in the next five, first one. The second one is that actually government's running a deficit is not such a bad thing. It's a good idea if you want to keep the economy ticking over to have the government sort of pumping a bit more money into the system. And particularly when you find interest rates for government borrowing are so very low, there really is no reason to say, okay, let's just knock ourselves out trying to close the deficit, pay down the debt and all the rest of it. So the OBR are presenting this as like, it's an option. It's not one that we have to follow through on. The bit that is challenging, I think, is that we're going to have to spend more money on the NHS, dealing with a world in which COVID-19 is basically endemic in some form. We're also going to have to spend more on the NHS because the population is aging. It's bigger than it was. There's lots more demands on healthcare one way or the other. We're going to have to spend more to improve schools and universities and all the rest of it. There's lots and lots of demands on public services looking ahead just to kind of stand still. I mean, social care is another obvious example. So it would be good to put up taxes to pay for that. If you're going to say we're going to put up taxes for the wealthy, and this, I think, is the argument that Labour in particular need to get ahead of now. They need to say now who's going to pay for this kind of post-pandemic world we want to build, and it should be the people with the broader shoulders. So that is where we need to get to there. We don't need to pay for the debt that we built up now. It's like the Second World War. We didn't rush to repay the debt from the Second World War, which was far higher, obviously, than the debt that we so far built up from coronavirus. We just let it over time because interest rates were fairly low, growth was moderate, inflation was not particularly high. The debt just kind of wears down gradually over time. At this point in time, with interest rates basically zero, it's really not something to worry about. So how you take claims about what's going to happen in the future, I think you have to read through the fact that these things are always a bit ideological, and actually there are lots and lots of other choices about what you might want to do in the future.
The reason I get James Meadway on when there's a big economic story is because he makes complex economic problems understandable to myself and to my audience. The BBC often struggle with this. So it seems to be habitual that especially their political commentators mystify more than they reveal when it comes to economic commentary. Someone who created some controversy on social media with her analysis, her explanation of economic fundamentals, it was Laura Koonsberg on Politics Live. We'll take a look at this. I'm going to get Ash's instant reaction to this afterwards.
Oh, it's just enormous, Joe. I mean, it's just absolutely eye-wateringly enormous. And if you think of the debate that we had really from the late noughties all the way through to the 2015 election, you know, that was defined by how's the country going to pay back what we had to borrow in the credit crisis. This is that and some. Okay, this is the credit card, the national mortgage, everything absolutely maxed out, enormous levels of the country basically being in the red. And as Faisal says, it's not really sort of a surprise. You know, we've all known that, seeing businesses shut, shops shut, pubs shut, people stuck at home, the economy basically put into a deep freeze for months on end. But seeing it spelt out like this in black and white is really, really stark. It's really, really important. And it just seems to me that today, in a sort of political sense, is maybe a more scary equivalent of that moment when the coalition took over in 2010 and David Laws, the chief secretary of the Treasury, leaked that note he'd been left from Liam Burns saying, there is no money left. This is Rishi Sunak standing and telling the country for the next few years, there is really no money. And of course, that's going to mean hugely difficult decisions in the years to come. But also the point that, Faisal, you were making this morning, we're not even through this, okay?
No.
This is the beginning of the economic emergency, perhaps the ending almost of the health emergency if the vaccines come good, as people hope for. But this is really only the beginning of the second act, and the third act, how we pay it back, is still a long way off.
That was Laura Koonsberg sort of giving points which were further to the right than Rishi Sunak. She's saying that the country's credit card is maxed out, we're running out of money, and this means that, I mean, essentially she's implying this means that austerity is going to have to come around the corner pretty soon. Economists aren't saying that. So why is the BBC's political editor saying that, Ash?
Well, look, I'm not going to make any sort of implication or inference about what her ideological leanings might be. What I will talk about is the structural role of this country's political journalists. They're not serious people and they're not serious about ideas. They're court historians, usually court stenographers, but court historians who prioritize access above all else. And so they're not really going to delve in that deep. They prefer the kind of pageantry and the contest of personality, and they're equipped to commentate on that, but not very much else. So I think that she's a reflection of the severely limited fields that she finds herself in. She's got lovely taste in jackets, though. Fantastic hair. Can't fault her. There's also a second problem, and it's a deeper problem. And I was thinking about this today, about economic storytelling, because how you explain the economy lays down the parameters of the space you have in which to move. All right. So how you choose to describe what's going on is, as James was saying, wholly ideological. And it sort of struck me today that 40 years on, we're still living in Thatcher's Britain. And the reason why I say that is because we have not escaped the world of metaphor, the world of illusion that she had constructed. Stuart Hall's writing on the language of Thatcher and the economy is very interesting, because one of the things that he identifies that Thatcher did was played into her gender. So she would say, I've been accused of preaching the parables of the parlor and the homilies of the housekeeper, but you know, I'm a woman and I know something about prudent household management. And of course, a national economy is just like a household economy. And so the minute you tell that story of a national economy is just like a household economy, you can't factor in the idea of borrowing is very cheap. I can't get to grips with that. You know, I didn't do economics. It doesn't seem to be instinctively true, because even my instincts as a leftist would go, oh, but I understand money and how much you've got and what you have to spend through my own household expenses. And that was a really powerful thing that Margaret Thatcher did. And that paradigm for understanding, right, that you can only spend what you have coming in and that is generated by the size of the economy, has stayed with us all of that time. And I think that if the left or, you know, anyone progressive wants to make any kind of headway in that, staying in the kind of lefty think tank world, which can be very, very technical, very, very dry, isn't going to cut it. What you have to do is tell a different kind of story. And I do think that James's reference to World War II and the way in which that debt was managed is a very smart way of doing that, because you're appealing to something that is already deeply wedged within the country's consciousness. You know, you're never more than two talking points away from World War II when it comes to the national conversation. And I think that can help you do that, can help you tell that different story. Because without that kind of story, which feels instinctively true, intuitively true, the left is going to have a very, very hard time building a kind of national case against austerity.
So Ash has brought up, yeah, the Second World War. I mean, what people might say there is that there was austerity after the Second World War. They'll sort of say, you know, people had rations. So how do you sort of, what's your elevator pitch to someone who is convinced that Britain has its credit card maxed out and some sort of austerity is going to be needed? How do you debunk Laura Koonsberg in 60 seconds?
Second World War story is easy because we had a choice after the Second World War. You could either go, oh my God, debt is now 200 or more percent of GDP, the highest it has ever been in this country. And you go, oh my God, we must panic and do nothing except worry about how to repay the debt and don't set up the NHS and don't massively expand education and don't set up the welfare state. Or you can go, that debt was for an exceptional period of time. We're going to set up the NHS, massively expand education, set up a welfare state, and they chose the latter. And we still live with that. And we don't live with debt because we've paid off the debt over a long period of time because it doesn't matter that much. That's the situation we're in now. If we could do it then just coming out of a war, we can do it now in a much, much richer country than we were back then. I mean, it's just, to me, that just seems fairly obvious. What I find spectacular, and Ash touched on this, I mean, it's not just Laura Koonsberg. There's a whole swathe of, it's not really the economics editors. I'd hope all the economics correspondents are better than this. It's the kind of political journalists. There's a whole swathe of them who are incapable of actually talking about what the economy is and how it works. Laura Koonsberg was not just wrong about how the government finances itself, watching that. She was even sort of factually wrong about what Rishi Sunak was doing. He didn't present a spending review that said, this is really serious, now we have to make cuts. He literally didn't say that. It's not even remotely true. Never mind that it's not true that the credit card is maxed out because there is no credit card. You then find Robert Pester, someone who's supposed to know about these things, giving the most nonsensical, garbled account of how quantitative easing works. Now, granted, quantitative easing is pretty weird, although in evidence it's fairly simple. The Bank of England issues electronic money and buys government debt with it. That's what it does. That's all you kind of need to say to get the basics. And it's completely garbled. And these people are wandering around. Never mind whether they're being ideological or secret Tories, they're just not very good at this. Like, they're getting the basics wrong. They're misinforming the public in really, really critically important ways. Now, what I find interesting in the middle of all this is that some of the institutions, like the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which was a big supporter of austerity, and people should remember that in the early 2010s, is now coming back and saying, well, it's a bad time to do it. You find that the consensus has shifted. The consensus even in the Tory party. Boris Johnson says he doesn't want to do austerity. See how long he sticks to this. But that consensus has shifted. Now, why on earth isn't Laura Koonsberg able to recognise this as somebody who's supposed to be, you know, politically attuned to the world is a bit beyond me.
It's not beyond me. And I think some of it is ideological affiliation, but I also think that the world of political journalism is stuffed to the gills with people who are there by virtue of their connections and their class and not their talent, quite frankly. And I think that you could throw a dart, hit any one of them and go, you're not here because you're good at thinking about things, right? I would say that that's the rule for that uppermost echelon of political journalists. Right, the good ones, and I'm not talking about ones which I deem good because I think we share values. There are plenty of ones where I think, you know what, you're a right-wing bastard, but my God, you know, you've got a clarity, a deftness, a sharpness to you, which is just undeniable. That's the exception. That is absolutely the exception. Mostly they're people who would love scurrying around SW1, absolutely high off their own farts, convinced of their own importance, because they're constantly talking to important people. Mm. That's the sum total of their job and how they derive their self-worth.
Next story. One of the most significant announcements from the spending review was that spending on aid would fall from 0.7% of GDP to 0.5%. So the change is being justified by the difficult fiscal circumstances, but it does contradict many promises made by the Tory frontbench in the very recent past. We can get up some of these. They were collected in the Politico morning email this morning, just to sort of show how quickly this U-turn has come about. We've got Michael Gove, June the 10th, 2019. I'm a supporter of maintaining 0.7% of our economy being spent on international development. Matt Hancock, June the 5th, 2019. I also support and will uphold the long-standing principle of spending 0.7% of GDP on international development. Alok Sharma, the business secretary, October the 21st, 2019. As far as I'm concerned, the 0.7% is a given. And most importantly, Boris Johnson on November the 24th in 2019, or this is the Conservative Party manifesto, page 53, presented by Boris Johnson. So the manifesto said, we will proudly maintain our commitment to spend 0.7% of GNI, gross national income, on development and do more to help countries receive aid become self sufficient. So you can see many a broken promise there. It was a manifesto commitment, and they're getting rid of it to save what amounts to about £4 billion. So when you think that we're 400 billion pounds, or the deficit is 400 billion pounds, and now they're saying we're going to break a manifesto commitment for £4 billion. Probably something else is going on here. Is it political? And we'll discuss that in a moment. First of all, let's look at Joe Coburn, Grill Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Stephen Barclay, about this decision to cut aid today.
The Archbishop of Canterbury has tweeted, "The cut in the aid budget made worse by no set date for restoration," which of course wasn't set today by Rishi Sunak, "is shameful and wrong. It's contrary to numerous government promises and its manifesto. I join others in urging MPs to reject it for the good of the poorest and the UK's own reputation and interests." That's pretty damning.
Well, as I say, we're spending £10 billion, which I think your viewers will still see as a very large sum given the wider fiscal situation. It's in the wider context of the third largest diplomatic network, the biggest sustained investment in defence, which also plays a role around the world in keeping people safe. All right. It sits along other investments. But what I'd say to the Archbishop is we have unprecedented levels of borrowing. We do want to return to 0.7 when the fiscal time allows us to do so.
When's that going to be? Because, you know, you can't tell. That could be never.
Well, we've said that's what we want to return to, but we also have to recognise you started the piece with this, £394 billion of borrowing. And the question really for the Archbishop is he saying that the government should ignore that level of borrowing or treat aid in isolation of the wider spend overseas and also ignore the fact that we will still be spending significantly more than our comparable countries? We're spending more than France, Italy, Canada, Japan, America. So we're spending more than those countries. Right. And perhaps the Archbishop might want to look at the spending of those countries before picking up on the spending of the UK.
So we're going to go to the polling on this in one moment to sort of basically explain why the Tories are doing this. But first, I do want to sort of focus on the consequences of this decision, because they're saying, look, we can't afford to spend this much money on aid because we've just had a pandemic, we're in lots of debt. I mean, what that doesn't take into account is that we're in a crisis. We can borrow lots of money because we're a rich country. This is a global pandemic. You know, every other country is in a crisis, and not all of them are in a situation or in a position to borrow money in the same way that we can. Interest rates aren't this low for everyone. So you are basically, you know, you're cutting people off from support at the moment when they need it most. It's a bit like if they said we're cutting the housing budget in the middle of a pandemic because we need to cut the debt, and they're like, you're making people homeless in a pandemic. It doesn't make any sense. James, I want to go to you on the sort of like economic policy consequences of this, the policy implications of it, and what you think of their justification.
Well, justification is nonsense. Like, in the same time they're saying, oh, well, borrowing this year is, what was it, 360, 380 billion pounds for this year. We're still going to have to spend another 55 billion next year. The deficit will remain, however large it's going to remain for the next 5 years. Debt is going to hit 105% GDP. And everyone's going, these are spectacular. Laura Coons spoke, this is mind-blowing figure. Da, da, da. And you're going, oh, here's 4 billion pounds you're going to scrape away out of this budget, which, by the way, is exactly the same amount as what they put into this levelling up fund. Mm. Right? It's £4 billion is going to the levelling up fund. So it's not like it's a saving because you're just going to spend the money on something else. And it's not like you need to make the saving because in the context of the £350 billion and more that you've spent this year, it's a pittance, right? So this is entirely, I think, driven by almost entirely driven by a kind of internal Tory party dispute. And it is a dispute. What's really striking is there's already a pushback on it. You know, there are quite serious people saying on the Tory side that we should not be doing this. And it does look incredibly short-sighted. DFID has a pretty good reputation around the world. You can criticise it in lots of different ways. You know, ways the Tories would probably not criticise it, like it spent too long acting as an arm for privatisation and this sort of thing. But it has a pretty good reputation around the world. Britain has a reputation as being a country that can apply this kind of money in places. The aid sector in general tends to view DFID with relatively good light, with some criticisms, but it's there. And you're just going to cut that at a time when you would have thought, if you're a national interest Tory, you're going to be trying to look for some friends around the world. It's a very, very perverse decision, and one driven really by what's happening on the Tory side, not by we have to make savings.
I mean, I think that mirroring of the levelling up fund and what's been cut from the aid budget is quite interesting. I think that's probably not accidental, because basically they've said, people say, oh, in difficult times, you shouldn't give money to other countries, you should give it here. They say, oh, well, we'll take 4 billion people off the developing world and we'll give it to primarily places that voted for Brexit, which is all them doing their Tory promise. Also interesting, though, actually, the way that Stephen Barclay there sort of said, well, look, yeah, we might be cutting the aid budget, but we're increasing the military budget, which... isn't much good to people living in the global south. But if you're interested in projecting British power, then yes, I suppose one can make up for the other. I want to get up some commentary on how this is going to play politically. This is from an ex-Downing Street pollster. Foreign aid comes up all the time in focus groups from all sides. More than 80% of swing Tory voters in the South and Red Wall voters agree that government should always put needs of British people ahead of others. As far as voters are concerned, this is a winning moment for the Conservatives. And then from the Times deputy political editor, internal government polling suggests 80% of public favour cutting foreign aid target. Apparently there's support for move across all groups of voters. Why is it the case that it seems that what these focus groups and pollsters are suggesting is that the government, the public do get quite annoyed about money going overseas for aid, and one has to ask why people get more annoyed about that than they do about tax avoidance, than they do about the Tories wasting billions on their mates for PPE that doesn't work. What's going on here?
Okay, I mean, short answer, racism. Right. Short answer is, why should we be paying for these people? They're not ours, they're not our own, we have scarce resources, they don't deserve it. Okay, so that's the story there, and it is very, very simple. And it's one which fits into other kinds of myths which play out on the domestic political terrain about the deserving and the undeserving poor, the workers versus the parasites. And this idea of countries in the global south, and in particular Africa, this idea that it is 100% populated from, you know, Morocco down to the Cape of, you know, pot-bellied, starving, grasping, you know, suspiciously melanated people is an image which has also been perversely reinforced by the aid industry over a period of decades. Sympathy only goes so far, and the flip side of sympathy is contempt. And I think that those images have really nurtured a sense of contempt amongst British people in this country. People want to, you know, open their purses for comic relief and whatever, but there's a slight element of disdain. A sense of shared humanity isn't necessarily a thing that drives philanthropy. And it means that when you're trying to make defenses of something like a foreign aid budget, it becomes really difficult because it is cutting against the grain of the popular mood. When it comes to why are people okay with, you know, huge sums of money being spent on bolstering the defense budget, Boris Johnson saying that he wants to see some of that money being used to develop laser guns. Well, again, this goes to the heart of how we see ourselves as a nation and how you want to see power projected across the world. Britain has never recovered from the loss of its empire. Rather, it's got the behavior of, you know, one of Freud's neurotics that both did and didn't have an empire. And if it had one, it was really good. But also, we'd quite like to bomb something, please. And essentially, this kind of bolstering of defense spending is a very expensive fig leaf to cover up the shame of that loss of empire. And again, the flip side of that, where you see you know, people on the centre-right and the centre-left making these spirited defences of foreign aid, is that there's an argument that that is the way to project soft power across the world. So again, it's kind of playing into this idea that what Britain has to be on the world stage is playing the role of a great power. Now, I am ambivalent about foreign aid in the sense that I think that there are some very good critiques of it. I don't think that merely increasing or decreasing the amount of foreign aid that's given by this country actually deals with the root causes of the underdevelopment of African and Asian countries. And I use the word underdevelopment very deliberately. Walter Rodney, who was a absolutely seminal decolonial thinker, wrote very famously a book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. Because the point isn't a lack of development. The point is that the wealth which is generated by African countries does not stay there. It is not distributed there. It's something which is, you know, transferred to the countries of the West. And you look at what's happened over, you know, even take the last 50 years, the sums of money which you can see in capital flight from 30 African countries far exceed the amount of money which is received in terms of foreign aid or the amount owed by those countries in terms of debt, right? So you have this ongoing underdevelopment of capital flight and wealth leaving these countries. Foreign aid does not do that. And in lots of cases, foreign aid is the lubricant of that underdevelopment, is the lubricant of that exploitation. And another thing is that you do see parts of the foreign aid budget, obviously not all of it, obviously not even most of it, but, you know, military aid trainings being given, you know, to the army, to police, to these forces which help bolster, you know, deeply corrupt political and economic settlements, because that is also to the benefit of Western countries. So I'm not saying that you look at this moment and a reduction in the foreign aid spend and you go, well, actually, this is a decolonial move, because obviously it's fucking not. I'm not an idiot. But I think that the left shouldn't get too sucked into taking a traditionally liberal point of view and you go, what you do is you defend foreign aid at all costs. I do think you've got to acknowledge these problems and essentially make an argument for reparations, for a much greater redistribution of global wealth and of global power, which is also about African countries, Asian countries, countries which were formerly colonized, having a stake in global democracy and global wealth management.
I agree with all of that. Very important points. I want to bring up a tweet from Tim Montgomery, not someone who we usually refer to on the show. Bit of a right winger. He used to work for Boris Johnson in Downing Street. He sort of summarizes quite well, I think, the opposition to this move. So he tweeted, Boris promised me twice he'd never abandon 0.7%, but who cares what he told me? He has broken a manifesto promise. He has broken a promise to world's poorest people when they need it most. Under this PM, Britain is becoming a nation that doesn't keep its word. Also, a minister from the Foreign Office has now resigned in sort of protest at this cutting of the budget. James, before we let you go, I want your sort of final thoughts on what this says about like global Britain. Is this just a sort of like one-off, let's get some good headlines, give some red meat to Tory backbenchers to sort of, I suppose, distract them from the fact that, you know, Rishi Sunak is still planning to spend quite a lot of money and continue a lockdown. They're already very annoyed about the lockdown continuing over the winter. So this is just a bit of red meat. Will we go back to 0.7% in a couple of years' time? Or is this sort of a sign of a reorientation of the British state to spend more money on defence, less money on aid, and that be more of a long-term strategy?
I don't think there's a long-term strategy at play here, and I don't think there's a long-term strategy. I mean, there are people out there who had something that looked a bit like a long-term strategy for this government, but at least one of them was booted out of his job about 2 weeks ago. So there's a bit of a scrap over where we should be going in all of this. And the cutting of foreign aid looks exactly like the sort of short-term appease your backbenchers, try and get some, drum up some headlines around it and see where you get to rather than something thought through. Because the big problem is going to be that legally, so Rishi Sunak has to kind of match a commitment to 0.7% of gross national income going on overseas aid. If he wants to get out of that, he has to change the law to do it. Legally, he's sort of tied to trying to make that happen, which means there has to then be a law going through Parliament setting out what the new law will be and how much we spend on aid. This was introduced by the Tories even in 2015. So he set up another row somewhere down the line. He set up a lot of other rows somewhere down the line. He set up a row probably in spring next year when he might want to start talking about tax rises or talking about more spending cuts or talking about a whole load of other things that he's parked with this spending review and he's kind of hidden under the cover of very, very cheap borrowing, lots and lots of quantitative easing, the rest of it. This is a holding position more than it is anything else. So there are a few bits and pieces that set out a bit of a direction or potential directions for the government, but it's quite hard to read out of this where we're going to end up in even 6 months' time, I think.
James Meadway, thank you so much for your time this evening. Anyone in our audience who wants to hear more from James in terms of his analysis of the spending review, I can see just before we went live, your article was published on NavarroMedia.com. So do make sure you go and check that out. Our audience, not you, James. You've presumably already read it as you wrote it. James, we'll speak to you soon.
Okay, thank you. See you all.
You guys know that this show is only possible because of your kind support. If you're already a subscriber, thank you very much. If not, please go to NavarroMedia.com/support. Next story. The Home Office have been found to have acted unlawfully when implementing changes to immigration rules that brought about the Windrush scandal. The Equalities and Human Rights Commission found that the hostile environment policy brought in under Theresa May's time as Home Secretary had harmed many people already living in the UK for many years. The main specific finding by the EHRC is that the Home Office unlawfully ignored warnings that the rule changes would harm British citizens. So we can go to some quotes from the BBC write-up. They write, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, the EHRC report, found a lack of organisation-wide commitment, including by senior leadership, to the importance of equality and the Home Office's obligations under the equality duty placed on government departments. It added, any action taken to record and respond to negative equality impacts was perfunctory and therefore insufficient. The report also said, from 2012, this hostile environment agenda accelerated the impact of decades of complex policy and practice based on a history of white and black immigrants being treated differently. In response, the Home Office have said they were determined to right the wrongs suffered by the Windrush generation and make amends for the institutional failings they faced, spanning successive governments over several decades. They added that the department was already applying a more rigorous approach to policymaking and would increase openness to scrutiny and create a more inclusive workforce, a bullied workforce, but just more inclusive, potentially. And then let's look at comment from campaigners on this issue. Satbir Singh, Chief Executive of the Joint Council for Welfare of Immigrants, said campaigners had repeatedly warned the Home Office that their hostile environment policies would inevitably lead to serious discrimination and to the denial of rights, particularly for people of colour. He added that successive Home Secretaries had ignored these warnings before the situation hit the headlines in 2018. Ash, I want your thoughts on this. Not particularly surprising, although it is good to see the government being held to account on this. Obviously, the hostile environment by sort of demanding to see papers from people constantly before they could get benefits, before they could rent a house, that ended up seeing many people who came to the country legitimately, had every right to live here. Many children of the Windrush generation saw them either being refused work, being refused benefits, or, you know, at worst, being deported. Ash, I want to get your thoughts on this report from the EHRC.
I mean, look, it's really great to see the EHRC release its Water is Wet report. It's not telling us anything new, not telling us anything that we didn't already know, but it is still important that it's released. There's one huge limitation in the EHRC's report, however. It refused to consider the question of whether the Home Office could be found to be institutionally racist because of its hostile environment policies. So this is a very strange thing in terms of the EHRC binding its own hands, pulling its punches in what should be a real reckoning for the government, holding them to account for the absolute scandal of the Windrush crisis. Because let's remind ourselves about what the Windrush crisis actually was, right? Because it has its origins really in, you know, the mid-20th century, when people from the Commonwealth, from the Caribbean, were invited to come to this country to staff the NHS, to staff the transport network, all of these things. They brought their children with them, as they had every right to do. And the documentation of those arrivals, the landing cards, were destroyed by the Home Office a short time ago. And it's being destroyed by the Home Office around about the same time you've got policies coming in which would necessitate this paperwork, you know, being submitted before you can access the kinds of services that you'd paid for all your life for your national insurance and for your tax contributions. So that's what the Windrush scandal was, is that one, it was creating a second class tier of citizenship based on nothing but the color of somebody's skin, right? The sense that you might be a migrant, you've got to prove your legitimacy to be in this country, and you can't access these services in a way that somebody, you know, who was white and not under such suspicion would be able to. You then have the issue of removals, because the point of the hostile environment, and this is why it was called the hostile environment, was that you make conditions for people who are deemed to be, you know, undocumented or irregular migrants so miserable that they want to leave the country themselves. And that was the case for many, many people who were part of that Windrush generation. It got to the point where they needed healthcare, got to the point where they needed dental surgery, got to the point where they needed to, you know, access these state services. It was so difficult, and they became so impoverished that they chose to self-remove. And then you have, on top of that, the wrongful deportations. Some of those people who were deported to countries that, you know, many of them hadn't been to since they were children, they died there. They died there before they could get their compensation. Even people who weren't deported, there was a case of one gentleman, I remember reading about him in an Avara Media article. He couldn't access dental care because he couldn't find his documentation his teeth ended up falling out, and he was so isolated and so ashamed that he just didn't leave the house. He just didn't see people. He just didn't socialize. He became incredibly depressed. And the sum awarded him was absolutely paltry. No way was it fitting for the kind of pain and distress that had been caused to him because of what the government had put him through. And none of this is in our political rearview mirror. It's still going on. It's absolutely still going on. On the 2nd of December, there is a charter flight scheduled to deport dozens of people to Jamaica in the middle of a pandemic. In the middle of a pandemic, this is the priority. And many of the people who are due to be on that flight have lived in this country since early childhood. And this flies in the face of a recommendation, an official recommendation made by the man appointed by the government to lead a review into the immigration practices. He said, look, people who were born here and don't have citizenship, or people who've lived here since early childhood and don't have citizenship, really, they shouldn't be deported, even if they've committed a crime. They should be treated in the same way that a British person would, because for all intents and purposes, they're as British as you and me, Michael. They really, really are. Home Office still isn't heeding the advice that's been given to it. It has absolutely no intention, I think, of addressing the concerns raised in this report. I think you'll see some shuffling around, but essentially the principles of the hostile environment will remain in place.
One of the reasons why these charter flights are so worrying is because, you know, it's cheaper for them to send everyone at the same time. So they end up basically rushing everyone's process, which gives people less chance to appeal. Very worrying. Ash, I don't know if you know the state of resistance to this. Is there any sort of pushback?
So I know that Detention Action is coordinating some of the pushback for this. I imagine that constituency MPs will be alerted, and those who want to will probably take up the cases of their constituents. But obviously with the pandemic, the kind of direct action that groups might want to take is highly limited. There's also limited bandwidth in terms of news coverage for this kind of thing. They see Windrush as very much Theresa May's scandal. And even though the practices are still ongoing, there's not much of an appetite for pressing the Home Office or that, putting them under all that much pressure to respond to this. I do think it's so critical for one, the left to absolutely hammer the Shadow Home Secretary and the Shadow Immigration Minister over this issue. Labour, at the moment, under Keir Starmer, they have a tendency to only identify problems when they've already happened. This is an opportunity for Keir Starmer and his front bench to show some leadership and some real moral clarity. And I think the other thing that we can do is, at the very least, signal boost the calls for help and the calls to action that Detention Action are putting out at the moment. They're looking for child psychologists so that reports can be made, which would help make the case for these individuals to have their right to remain respected. Things of that nature, really, really helpful.
We are going to go on to our last story. The Labour Party bureaucracy, allied with Keir Starmer, is using every dirty trick available to stop Labour members exercising their democratic right to defend Jeremy Corbyn. 39 constituency Labour parties have passed motions in solidarity with Jeremy Corbyn and called for the whip to be reinstated. At least 17 more have tried but have had the motion ruled out of order. That means someone's told them, you're not even allowed to debate this, you can't discuss this. We have also tonight got an exclusive email, which was leaked to us, showing the party are committed to preventing anyone debating Starmer's highly political decision to override the ruling of an NEC panel and withdraw the whip from Jeremy Corbyn. So when this was in the disciplinary phase, when Jeremy Corbyn was in the official disciplinary channels within the Labour Party, they were telling CLPs, local Labour parties, you can't discuss this suspension because this is within the disciplinary process and that shouldn't be politicised. Now, because Jeremy Corbyn is not in the formal disciplinary process, he's had the whip removed by Keir Starmer, a political act, explicitly political act, they've had to come up with more excuses, different excuses, more novel excuses to silence ordinary Labour Party members. Let's go to this email to see what line they are pushing at the moment to try and shut up Labour members who are saying things that the leadership don't necessarily like. So this is an email from the head of internal governance to all regional directors. Sent today. It says, we are aware that there are a lot of questions incoming around what motions may or may not be in order given developments over recent days. To confirm, the Labour Party disciplinary case against the former leader has now concluded. However, it has become clear that motions around this issue, including expressions of solidarity, views around the ongoing process in relation to the parliamentary whip, and or the power of the General Secretary or the NEC to issue guidance in relation to discussion of this issue, are providing a flashpoint for the expression of views that undermine the Labour Party's ability to provide a safe and welcoming space for all members, in particular our Jewish members. Therefore, all motions which touch on these issues must be ruled out of order. Later in the email, it goes on, finally, as we have previously advised, we will not hesitate to take appropriate action, including against individual members where our rules and guidance are not adhered to or standards of behaviour fall below that which we expect. We will be reinforcing this message via an email to CLPs in the next day or two. That's from Fraser Welsh, who is head of internal governance. So that's been sent out to regional directors. It will go out to CLPs, but it'll be regional directors who are enforcing this kind of thing, because as we've seen around the country, there are many CLP chairs and secretaries who do want to be debating these motions to express their solidarity with Jeremy Corbyn, getting a bunch of them suspended. You'll see in Bristol West, which is one of the biggest CLPs in the country, you've had the co-secretaries, the chairs, suspended for allowing a motion about Jeremy Corbyn to go forward, and now they're banned from having meetings until February. Really, really authoritarian manoeuvres here. I want to focus, though, on what's in this email, because you know, we've talked before about how the Labour Party approach to this has been really ad hoc. They've basically made up rules as they go along when they want to avoid outcomes they don't like. The outcome they don't want here is members expressing their solidarity with Jeremy Corbyn. Keir Starmer has made a very political decision to suspend the whip from him. That's basically to appease people within the Labour Party and also avoid awkward headlines. I don't know what he's trying to do. Basically, we're going to go on to what the whip is asking Jeremy Corbyn to do in a moment. Equally ridiculous. But what they are trying to do is shut up people from expressing any dissent, and they're using any excuse possible. So before, as I said, when this was in the disciplinary processes, they were saying you can't debate this because it's a disciplinary matter. Now they're saying you can't debate this because possibly if you were to debate this, someone might say something which makes someone else feel uncomfortable. So people are now being sort of banned from speaking about something because of what might potentially be said. You know, people aren't being punished for things they've said. People are being prevented from having a conversation because of what might possibly be said. You know, now this is really Orwellian. If you get to rule out and ban anyone hearing emotions where they judge that someone might possibly say something which is offensive, then we're in very, very worrying territory. Especially when, you know, Keir Starmer, all of these Labour MPs, they've had every opportunity to have their voice heard when they go on the radio and say, no, I completely support his whip being removed, blah, 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 blah. Members don't normally get invited onto LBC. They don't get invited onto the day, onto the Today programme on Radio 4. The only way they can express their opinions is through, and be heard, is through the democratic structures of the Labour Party. So basically you're saying Keir Starmer is allowed an opinion. Margaret Hodge isn't allowed an opinion. All of the Labour frontbench are allowed an opinion. But if you, a lowly member, want to have an opinion on the suspension of the former Labour leader, well, you're not allowed. We might even suspend you if you try. That's the situation with local parties. We're also in a pretty dark situation when it comes to other bodies, other democratic bodies within the Labour Party. Young Labour, for example, that's the official party organ for those under 27. So this Saturday, the democratically elected Committee for Young Labour agreed a statement in support of Corbyn, which they released on Twitter. We can take a look at that. So they write, thousands of young people were inspired to join and support our movement by Jeremy Corbyn in a world with few politicians like him. The removal of the whip, despite the lifting of Jeremy's suspension, is a betrayal of them and blatant factional interference in disciplinary matters. Instead of disregarding due process, Keir Starmer should immediately reinstate the whip and end these attacks on the left so that we can get on with the task of delivering a socialist Labour government to transform this country. This move distracts from the important findings of the EHRC report, from the critical work of tackling anti-Semitism within the party, and violates a key recommendation of the EHRC report that disciplinary matters must be free from political interference. Now, those tweets, all very reasonable, were posted by Jess Barnard. She is a Norfolk County Councillor and a youth worker. She is also chair of Young Labour. She's been a member of the Young Labour Committee for 4 years, but was recently elected. In a Omov ballot, one member, one vote, to all young members, she was elected by an overwhelming margin to become its chair. I spoke to her earlier today to ask what happened after Young Labour posted those tweets.
On the Monday, I received an email from the party letting me know that the statement needed to come down immediately and alleged that we were using or misusing Labour Party branding to talk about a factional or disciplinary issue. Obviously, I followed that up with the party and I challenged that, and I do, following my statement, obviously feel quite uncomfortable being asked to override the votes of the committee and to withhold their right to make statements on political issues within the party. I have responded to the party with about a series of 10 questions asking them to clarify where this rule is and, you know, what they're reliant upon based on saying that we can't use Labour Party branding to make political statements. I don't think it's fair to say that this is a factional issue. I think it's an issue of democracy, and there really isn't any precedent for the party to intervene in this way. And if we look at European youth wings of political parties, they often really politically differ from the main party, but the party respects that and respects the autonomy. So the party hasn't referred to any rules that Young Labour has broken. I don't believe that Young Labour has broken any rules. And whether you agree or disagree with the statement or not, it's a matter of democracy and a matter of the rights of young members to have a committee that can vote on political issues and represent them autonomously. With the leadership we've seen at the moment, there is just no way of knowing what the next steps are. I've made it really clear that I won't be overriding the committee. I think it would be completely undemocratic for me to do that. And the mandate that young members have given me, you know, the platform I stood on was on one that would fight for an autonomous, democratic, socialist Young Labour. I was really clear about that throughout the 4-month campaign that we went through. So morally, like, I can't override this. There isn't any rules that we've broken. I've not had a response from the Labour Party. So I'm really not sure what the next steps are, because we need to have a functioning relationship with the party. We need to be able to work together. We all want to see a Labour government, but the party needs to respect our right to make political statements. We aren't just a mouthpiece for Lotto's office. We are a collection of young members who are really passionate about putting a transformative Labour government in power. And so I'm sure that the committee will be continuing to fight for that, and that we will continue, as is our right, to be political and to organise young members and to build the structures that they deserve. But obviously, as we can see, it's going to be an uphill struggle for us to do that. But we are going to have to just pull together. And the solidarity we've had from members across the party, both young and older, has been overwhelming. So I think it's clear people really do want a Young Labour that is autonomous, even if they disagree with statements that are put out.
So that was Jess Barnard, the chair of Young Labour, who, when she was emailed by bureaucrats in party HQ to say, take down your tweets, she refused. She put up a public statement to say, this is what happened. This is why I'm not going to delete them. I have every right to do this. There are people in CLPs across the country doing the same. Ash, I want to bring you in on this. Who could have imagined, you know, when Keir Starmer got elected on that platform of, I believe in unity within the Labour Party, that what he would have done within 6 months of inheriting a party with 550,000 members, he would have first suspended the whip from the previous leader, and then basically used every method he possibly can to ban anyone from complaining about it. He's basically shutting down any particular organ of the party that wants to protest this, I mean, what is overtly a political move.
I mean, so here's what I think about the whole thing. One is that I did think that this was something that was going to happen. I didn't have the kind of optimism for Keir Starmer's leadership that I know that many other people did. And I'm not just talking about people who voted for Keir Starmer. I know people who were very heavily invested in Rebecca Long Bailey's campaign. But when Keir won with 10 pledges, which promised that he would stick to Corbyn's economic policy, but there would be a change in leadership style and emphasis on professionalising the party outfit, there are lots of people who went, well, you know what, that sounds really good. I'm willing to have the left be a junior partner in a Labour leadership, which is sort of led by broadly soft left principles. And the reason why I didn't feel all that optimistic is that, one, I think that Keir Starmer has always been something of, he's quite a ruthless political operator. He knew what it would take to become Labour Party leader. I think that he pursued that goal since 2015. And I'm not saying that as a derogatory thing at all. I'm saying that those were his goals and he achieved them. One of the ways in which he achieved them is by moving the Labour Party towards a much more Remain and pro-second referendum position that gave him a certain standing amongst a very pro-Remain membership. And I don't think that there was going to be a Keir Starmer who would stop there. He doesn't just want to be a leader of the Labour Party. He wants to be Prime Minister. He thinks, well, what does the country like and what does it dislike? Well, it really dislikes Jeremy Corbyn. So I'm not going to make it a line in the sand for my leadership to treat this man who was my predecessor in a way which is fair. I also think that Keir Starmer feels, and this is me completely speculating here, but with speculating here, but bolstered by words in my ears from some well-placed sources. I think that he feels a sense of frustration that the anti-Semitism issue is continuing to dog his leadership despite him, you know, not being Jeremy Corbyn. And he hasn't prepared for that. He hasn't prepared for that one bit. And I think that he really underestimated the extent to which anti-Semitism as a wedge issue would be wielded against him. Right, he wouldn't be allowed to move on from the issue unless authoritarian, quite brutal action was taken to marginalise or indeed exclude the left from his party. And I think that the signs of this were kind of always there. I think when it comes to Labour Party democracy, one of the things that Jess said is, you know, it's not a factional issue, it's an issue of democracy. Unfortunately, the history of the Labour Party shows that any attempt to democratise the party is itself a factional issue, because you have a parliamentary Labour Party and also a party machinery which is not representative of the views of its membership. You have a parliamentary Labour Party and a staffing culture which is significantly to the right of its membership. So any attempt to empower that membership, whether it's a youth wing or whether it's CLPs, is going to be met with factional resistance, because it is in itself a weakening of a particular faction's power. So that's one thing where I do disagree a bit. As for whether, you know, where this is going to go, I think that Keir Starmer strategically has ended up in a bit of a cul-de-sac. And I think that is because he underestimated the extent to which anti-Semitism would become a test for him, a test for whether he would be subject to factional attacks or not. And he's hemmed in by the fact that the left is in a much stronger position now than it used to be, in terms of the membership, in terms of parliamentary representation, in terms of places on the NEC. You know, getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn is not going to be any easy feat, as we've seen in the last few days. There is still a way out of this, and I think it's by climbing down from the position where you judge whether or not the party is institutionally anti-Semitic by whether or not one man is in it. And I think that this has been a core of the problem. People use the word institutional with regards to racism, not in its actual meaning. They're not actually interested in the kind of process or institutional culture which produces unequal outcomes. Right? And that's what institutional racism means. That was its meaning in the McPherson report. What they're using institutional racism to mean in this case, in the case of the Labour Party, anti-Semitism, and Jeremy Corbyn, is, does the Labour Party as an institution think that Jeremy Corbyn has a home here? Because as long as he does, it will be judged to be institutionally anti-Semitic. And the word institutional there basically just means big, just means bigly racist. And that's obviously completely untenable. Because you've got an EHRC report which identified problems with procedure and problems with rules, and now you've got a test of whether or not it's institutionally anti-Semitic in the court of public opinion and also amongst the Labour Party right and amongst you know, the Jewish community leadership, the Board of Deputies, you know, being one, which says that, well, the rules will be deemed to fail for as long as they allow Jeremy Corbyn to be here. And you can't just rewrite and rewrite rules to get rid of one person. Completely untenable. It's going to be, you know, a kind of death by a thousand cuts for Keir Starmer's own moral authority and his leadership. The best thing he can do is actually climb down from some of these really impossible tests that have been set for him and that he set for himself.
You've said they can't rewrite rules to get rid of one man they don't like. It seems they're also willing to rewrite history. I want to bring up a letter from the chief whip. So this is Nick Brown. This was sent to Jeremy Corbyn on Monday. And whilst, this is another relevant point, whilst CLPs and even Young Labour are banned from having any kind of opinion on this case, the chief whip released this letter publicly. So it was very much to say, this is our position. Everyone should be able to read it. I'm going to use my platform to, well, I think, smear Jeremy Corbyn, but let's have a look at the letter and you can see if you agree with me. So the letter from Nick Brown to Jeremy Corbyn. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but these are the key extracts. So Nick Brown writes, within an hour of the EHRC report's publication, you issued a statement on Facebook, which has not yet been removed, that included the following paragraph. One anti-Semite is one too many, but the scale of the problem was also dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents inside and outside the party, as well as by much of the media. That combination hurt Jewish people and must never be repeated. Nick Brown then writes, that statement in particular, the implication that this form of racism is exaggerated and that it is media reporting of that racism rather than the actual impact on its victims, that hurt Jewish people, caused significant distress to many, in particular Jewish members of the Labour Party and the wider Jewish community. Shortly after publishing that statement, you were placed under investigation by the Labour Party pursuant to the disciplinary procedures set out to the Labour Party's rule book. And I want you to focus on that point where he's saying, you were saying it's the reporting of racism rather than actual racism that hurt Jewish members. I want you to remember that because it's a misrepresentation. Anyway, this is what Nick Brown demanded of Jeremy Corbyn. So he says, in order to inform the investigation that is underway, I ask you to consider the following questions. Will you unequivocally, unambiguously, and without reservation apologize for your comments made on the morning of 29th of October 2020, in particular for saying one anti-Semite is too many, but the scale of the problem was also dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents inside and outside the party, as well as by much of the media, which caused such distress and pain to Jewish members of the Labour Party. It goes on, can you confirm that you'll be complying immediately with the request of the sub-panel of the Labour Party's NEC disputes panel by either removing the Facebook post or editing it to remove the sentence indicated? And can you give me assurances that you will cooperate fully with the Labour Party as it seeks to implement the recommendations set out in the EHRC report? Now, I've said this is all incredibly misleading. And remember, this was a publicly released letter. So this has, you know, this has reputational implications. The reason it's misleading is because he took a quote fundamentally out of context. So the quote he took, one anti-Semite is too many, but the scale of the problem was also dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents inside and outside the party, as well as by much of the media. That combination hurt Jewish people and must never be repeated. So Nick Brown is suggesting, or Nick Brown is using that paragraph to say that Jeremy Corbyn is saying that the hurt was only caused because of a combination of exaggeration by people inside the party, outside the party, and in the media. Saying you're saying it was all because of exaggerations that people were so hurt by this. Now, why this is a problem is because that's not the combination Jeremy Corbyn was talking about. This is actually what I think is the relevant extract from his Facebook post on the day that the EHRC report was released. So Corbyn wrote then, anyone claiming there is no anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is wrong. Of course there is, as there is throughout society. And sometimes it is voiced by people who think of themselves as on the left. Jewish members of our party and the wider community were right to expect us to deal with it. And I regret that it took longer to deliver that change than it should. One anti-Semite is one too many, but the scale of the problem was also dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents inside and outside the party, as well as by much of the media. That combination hurt Jewish people and must never be repeated. So you can see that when you read that paragraph in context, it's not just the combination of exaggeration by party opponents and the media that caused the hurt. It's the combination of that exaggeration with real anti-Semitism within the Labour Party and the real failures of Labour's disciplinary processes to nip that in the bud. We know they didn't. We know they failed to nip that in the bud. Sorry, no one's really disputing that. But I find it very difficult to dispute that that combination is one of the things that really hurt Jewish people. And the fact that Nick Brown has to basically misrepresent Jeremy Corbyn in a public letter, I think shows how weak their case is. You might also ask, oh, but he shouldn't have said that, because it wasn't the combination of exaggeration and actual anti-Semitism that caused the hurt in the Jewish community. It was only the actual anti-Semitism. Now, for one to believe that, to think that what Jeremy Corbyn said is unreasonable, one would either have to say there was no exaggeration of the problem. And actually, I want to point you to an article which I've been returning to, which is by Jamie Stern Weiner on that question. He was writing about the 2017 party conference, where newspapers were full of headlines everywhere saying that Holocaust denial was a big deal at Labour Party conference, and that there were threats made from the stage, when actually it was just someone saying, be careful when you implement this rules. They made it out to be people saying, be careful to people who said, you know, so much misrepresentation. And then the question of, okay, so it was misrepresented, but people don't really believe what they read in the media. I introduce you to the British public's relationship to migration, right? If you think that people never have an exaggerated sense of threats because of reporting by the media, then how is it that people think that 80 people crossing in a dinghy from the Channel is an existential threat to British life? You know, the idea that it's controversial to say it was a combination of poor reporting on this and real anti-Semitism, and a real failure by the complaints process to look into it. The idea it should be controversial to say it was that combination that caused so much damage, I'm not really sure anyone believes it. I mean, the point to make initially is that those demands that have been made of Jeremy Corbyn, he's not going to do that. He's not going to say, oh, I apologize unconditionally and without any reservation for something that he believes to be true.
I mean, what we also see here is a kind of mission creep. So the demands being made of Jeremy Corbyn, to row back on what he said, far exceed anything that the EHRC identified as either being anti-Semitic or contributing to an institutional culture of indirect discrimination against Jewish people. The EHRC report makes specific allocations for the right to differ on one's opinion of the scale of the anti-Semitism problem. It says that that's an Article 10 right. And so if it's an Article 10 right, it's one that Jeremy Corbyn enjoys. It's one that means that he shouldn't be disciplined by the NEC for it. Indeed, his suspension was lifted. And if this temporary suspension of the whip is being used as a pretext for another kind of, you know, investigation, measuring up against the guidelines set out in the EHRC report or any of Labour's existing rules, is going to come to the same conclusion. What's being asked of Jeremy Corbyn with relation to the advice that Labour has been given to act on anti-Semitism is completely out of line. Right. The question about what kind of political latitude does Starmer have to be able to do this, however, well, it's a political decision whether or not he has the whip. And there are things in Starmer's favour should he want to keep Jeremy Corbyn out of the parliamentary party, i.e. he's got the backing of most of the country's press and most of the MPs within his own party. The things against him is that the trade unions would be likely to remove funding, and that also Jeremy Corbyn might wish to initiate legal proceedings, especially if he's being treated in ways which run completely contrary to what's in the Labour Party's own rule books. That's what I think in terms of the request which is being made of him. But I think that there's a bigger question here, and it's one which I would like to pass as thoughtfully as possible. I think that one of the effects of the anti-Semitism crisis is that it has made there being any sense of a shared social reality in which we all live, in which we can all discuss racism, whether that racism is anti-Semitism, whether it's discrimination against travellers and Roma people, whether it's Islamophobia, whether it's anti-blackness, we do not exist in that shared space. And part of the reason is because the anti-Semitism crisis and the level of bandwidth that's taken up in terms of our political media, and also the party's intransigence on matters pertaining to its disciplinary processes, it's very real failures in that case, has led to a real sense of a hierarchy of racism. And I think that there are different opinions on what that hierarchy constitutes. I think that there are, you know, lots of Jewish people who feel that the left has a particular blind spot and reluctance to recognize anti-Semitism as being a form of racism which is as serious or as bad as Islamophobia or anti-blackness. I think that there are lots of Jewish people who think that the Labour Party's particular intransigence to deal with the inadequacies in its disciplinary processes is a reflection of that hierarchy of racism in which anti-Semitism is considered at the bottom. And you also have a very real feeling amongst Black people and amongst Muslims, against travellers and Roma people, that it is not as if the Labour Party has ever been particularly good at recognising and acting upon those forms of racism either. And what's more, there is much less space taken up within political media and within, you know, politics more generally, on behalf of those identity groups. And what really worries me is that the longer that this drags out, the more degraded that shared terrain of anti-racist struggle becomes. And I really worry about the consequences of that for, you know, people of color, for racial and for religious minorities, because it's going to get hard under this Tory government. It's going to get really, really hard. And I think that there is a corrosive lack of trust and a sense of, you know, real woundedness. And that's bigger than Keir Starmer. That's bigger than Jeremy Corbyn. And it's bigger than the Labour Party.
I forgot we had a video. And this is a video I unearthed earlier in the week of another crank who probably deserves a letter from the chief whip for daring to suggest that attacks on Jeremy Corbyn might be politically motivated.
The attacks on Jeremy Corbyn in that election we've just had were terrible. And they came back at us on the door. They vilified him, and they knew what they were doing, and they knew why they were doing it. And they do it to every Labour leader, and they know why they're doing it. Now, we've just lost the election, so we better prepare for the next one. And it's going to happen again, and it needs to change. We need to cut through that. This city has been wounded by the media. The Sun in this city are hurt for this city. And I certainly won't be giving any interviews to The Sun during the course of this campaign.
That was his stupidest speech that he gave in the leadership election. I won't be giving any interviews to The Sun during the Labour leadership campaign. Labour members don't read The Sun. That's not a commitment. Doesn't make any sense. But anyway, the important thing there is that Keir Starmer stood on a platform where he was saying, I understand that the attacks against Jeremy Corbyn were politically motivated, right? Now, he doesn't have to say all of them were, but he understands that we live in a context where the attacks against Jeremy Corbyn were often politically motivated by people who did not want a socialist Labour government. Now you'll say, okay, so he wasn't explicitly talking about anti-Semitism there. Maybe he was just talking about the Czech spy stuff, or maybe he was just talking about the, I don't know, what were the other controversies? And it makes a difference where I'm saying what were the other controversies, because nearly all the controversies were about anti-Semitism, right? So whilst, you know, I'm the first person to agree, it wasn't the crisis that happened, the hurt that was caused to Jewish people wasn't just because of exaggeration. There was also a great deal of mishandling from the leadership on this question. But the idea that Jeremy Corbyn's political opponents exaggerated his problems only when it came to Czech spies and only when it came to the amount of money they'd spend on various nationalisation programmes, but not on the one issue that was most damaging to Jeremy Corbyn, I don't really see how that's credible. And so for the person who said, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is subject to all of these politically motivated attacks, to now say, if you question any of the attacks, which is on the issue which was most damaging to him, then you can't even be in the party. And you just have to think, how duplicitous is this man? You know, because he said that for a reason. That was, you know, he prepped in advance of those hustings, and he knew that to get the support of Labour members, he had to show an understanding of how the establishment in this country did everything in their power to destroy Jeremy Corbyn and his leadership. If he'd stood up there at the hustings and said, actually, I think the vast majority of attacks at Jeremy Corbyn were perfectly valid. I think we should stop questioning what's in the media because the media generally tells the truth about Labour leaders. If he'd said that at those hustings, he would not have been elected. So he's saying one thing in a very well-prepared hustings, where he's saying, look, I'm one of you. I understand you guys. I understand that the reason Jeremy Corbyn was vilified was because he was a socialist and he was going to transform British social policy and foreign policy. I understand you guys. You can trust me. Then the moment he's in power, on the issue that was most damaging to Jeremy Corbyn, he says, if you dare suggest that this was exaggerated by the opponents of Jeremy Corbyn, not that it was all exaggerated, but that in part it was exaggerated, then you can't even be in the party. Even Jeremy Corbyn, the person who was attacked, if he says that, if he tries to defend himself, he can't be in the party. And you just, oh, he's so duplicitous. I do not trust this man. I'm sounding like Aaron Bastani. I used to try and be more forgiving of Keir Starmer, give him a bit more time, say sort of like, well, we might as well wait and see what can we do anyway. But now I just do not trust this guy. He's so shifty. I want to bring up a tweet from Sienna Rogers from Labour List, which was tweeted today. She writes, understand that legal proceedings have started today and Corbyn's team believe their upcoming release of written correspondence will remove any ambiguity that there was a deal between them and the leader's office on Corbyn's reinstatement to the party. The leadership of Keir Starmer's people are denying there was a deal. They're just saying, oh, we asked Corbyn to do something. They asked us to let him back in. It's not a deal. It's just requests coming from both sides. Whether or not there was an understanding, maybe both sides had a different understanding of what had gone on, or maybe when these emails or texts or whatever they are released, we will see that the story up to now isn't quite as Keir Starmer has suggested it would be.
The Labour leadership feel really embarrassed by where their support is strongest. But that is the demographic which is only going to become more and more important as those older demographics age out of the electorate. And so unless you make an appeal to them, and I'm not just talking about along the lines of political culture, though that is really important. You know, the treatment of, you know, Jess Barnard and Young Labour is absolutely atrocious if what you want to say is that, you know, we are a home for young people who want to have their voices represented. It's also about what kind of, you know, material pitch you're making to them. You know, Keir Starmer doesn't talk about the young unless they're somebody's children, right? He makes appeals to people as parents, but he doesn't talk about young renters, young people in the labour market. You know, he doesn't talk much about, you know, student debt. And I think that that's going to be a real issue for him, because you made this, you know, pitch to a membership which is, you know, has had an influx of young people because of Jeremy Corbyn, and then you immediately abandoned it. Well, voters are going to be able to see through that too.
I think as a strategy, it just doesn't work. I mean, because he can say, look, most of these decisions he's making in the short term are popular. You know, as you say, Jeremy Corbyn isn't very popular. In general, you ask the public, do you think it's good that the whip was removed from Corbyn? And the majority say they do. But when you look at the breakdown of that, all of the people who are strongly opposed to it are Labour voters, right? Now, you need to win more than them, but you also you need to win more than those people, those very committed Corbynite Labour supporters, to win a general election. You also need to reach out to Labour Tory swing voters, etc. But you do need them. If you don't have those committed Labour voters voting for Labour, if they vote for the Greens or the Lib Dems or whatever, then he cannot become Prime Minister. Let's end there. We can go into the night. Ash Sarkar, a pleasure as always.
Cool, thank you for having me. I look forward to this. It's the best part of my week, and I'm not funning you. I'm being real.
I believe you. It's best part of mine as well. Not that I have favourites. Thank you for watching Tisky Sour. If you want to support the work we do, please go to navarramedia.com/support. It is ever so much appreciated. We'll be back at 7 p.m. on Friday. You've been watching Tisky Sour on Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.